the idea that you're going to be extinguished when you finally realize that that is the most factual fact about life, then you think, well, that wasn't very long. You know, it seems like it's going to last forever when you're a kid. But then you start to realize it's shorter. So if it's not going to last that long, I think it would be a good idea to feel good about things as much as you can.
That was Alan Alda. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is Talk Easy. Welcome to the show. Everyone, this is Talk Easy. Welcome back, or if you have not been listening, welcome. We are on a brief hiatus until we return on August 25th with the one and only Whitney Cummings. But until then, we are playing some of my favorite episodes over the past 3 years since we started the show in, I think it's April of 2016. I could be wrong, but I think it's that. And the one today is with Alan Alda. He really does not need an introduction. If you are unfamiliar with his work, I guess I would point you to MASH. If you have not seen MASH, I could point you to any number of his films and television shows. My personal favorites are The Four Seasons and Crimes and Misdemeanors. In this episode, we dive into his childhood in burlesque, his ongoing battle with face blindness. That is not a joke. He actually has face blindness. And how a brush with death gave him a sort of renewed lease on life. There are a couple stories in this interview. I only knew about this after the fact. But there are a couple stories in this interview that even his assistants and even one of his children did not know. So it is my attempt with all of these episodes, but especially with folks who are over the age of, 75, that we come prepared and try to dive into some uncharted territory. So I really, really love this episode with Alan Alda. He is a legend. He is incredibly sincere and forthright. And we had the privilege of having him on. I don't know how we got him to say yes, but it was actually rather painless. And if you have not heard of his podcast, it is called Clear Plus Vivid. It is on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, and it's really a joy. So check his podcast out. And without further ado, here is the one and only Alan Alda. You know, I've done a whole bunch of research for today, and there's, I think, about 7,000 different places to start, but something I stumbled upon that I'm fascinated by is that you said, I think as recently as last year, that I don't think we're really listening unless we're willing to be changed by the other person.
Yeah, that's kind of a radical idea I came up with, I think, about 10 years ago, maybe 15. And I know it's radical. I know it sounds ludicrous. Why would we want to be changed by somebody else, especially if they are saying things we strongly and deeply don't agree with? But unless unless I open myself up to the other person when they're talking to me and really let them in and be open and vulnerable, I don't have a moat around me. And I don't say, you can only get in if you come in with something I already agree with. If I let you in with an opposing idea and consider it with the same respect I have for my own ideas, I'm liable to be changed in some way by that, and I have to be willing to do that. Otherwise, I don't think I'm listening.
Well, I think that's the heart. You asked me what this show is about, and I think that's pretty much the heart of it. So I want to start in Manhattan, 33rd Street and 3rd Avenue.
That's where I started.
Yeah, and oddly enough, I'm picking a date out of the hat, and that's what came out. You strike me as someone who has a pretty strong memory. What is your earliest memory of childhood?
My very earliest set of memories are in the burlesque theater, standing in the wings, watching my father and burlesque comics and chorus girls and strippers up in the strippers. The chorus girls. I was never up in the strippers' dressing rooms. I was always up in the chorus girls' dressing rooms. They were very motherly to me.
What do you think growing up in the wings of burlesque and really in the heart of entertainment, what do you think that does to a kid at that age?
Well, it makes you think that you're in a privileged class, that the rest of the people in the world are civilians who are damaged by not having the life you have, traveling from town to town, putting on shows, making people laugh, drinking and gambling in the train all night on the way to the next town. Not that I drank and gambled, but that was my life. I saw it, and I was part of the joke-making even at an early, early age. And you think that that's going to be your life forever.
Well, at some point, it's not your life forever. When do you feel like you started your own life? When did you feel like you had autonomy for the first time?
Well, in a way, it did become my life because I became an actor and a writer. And a lot of people in those companies were writers, too. They would write these hokey burlesque sketches. But they were creative, and they were improvisers. They would some part of their performance would be improvised along with what was traditional. There were black books of typewritten sketches that when they were piled on a table, they were almost a yard high. Mm. And that was the foundation of most burlesque shows. These sketches were passed from one person to another. I was never aware of anybody saying, I wrote that sketch and you stole it from me. Mm-hmm. Seems like everybody did Handful of Nickels. Everybody did The Crazy House. Mm. Everybody did Slowly I Turn. And then when Abbott and Costello got famous after they left burlesque, they continued to do those sketches, and everybody thought of them as Abbott and Costello sketches, like Who's On First. But they weren't. They belonged to everybody, as far as I know. I don't know who wrote them, though.
Well, you know, it's funny because comedy nowadays, people claim territory on it. But I was watching The Four Seasons this morning.
Oh.
And it's the first film you directed. You're in it. And there is a bit on the boat. I'm trying to think, like, at the top of the boat. And I think you're not putting your sail up, but something's happening where you say, keep going, keep going, keep going, and then it falls off and clearly breaks. And it's, to me, beat to beat, one of the early jokes in Bananas, when the car is going backwards and he says, keep going, keep going, keep going. So, okay, great. And then by the time he says, you know, stop, they've crashed into the car.
Right.
And so the point of this is that it feels like comedy has a long history, and oftentimes, you know, our comedy is an amalgamation of the things we've consumed.
Yeah, well, that's a fancy way of saying I stole the joke, which I did. I loved the joke, and I just stole it. But it wasn't two cars. It was on a boat. So, of course, it's entirely different. I'm entirely qualified to steal the joke. I apologize to Woody Allen for stealing his joke. At least I stole it after his movie came out. He never shows actors the script of a movie he's about to shoot because the jokes get passed around and they wind up in other movies before they wind up in his, or before his comes out. So I did him this incredible honor of stealing the joke after the movie came out. You're the only person who ever caught that, by the way.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Alan, I'm so sorry that this had to happen in 2018, 40 years removed.
They can't put you in jail. It's the what do you call that when they can't put you in jail? Statute of limitations.
Yes, it's past the statute of limitations.
Right. I'm not going to comedy jail for that.
You know, I think if you were going to go to comedy jail, you would have already been there by now. So I think
you're that's
fine.
The only thing I ever stole. What are you talking about?
Yeah. You know, you got married in 1957. I know you were in the Army a little bit before that. You described the time after being married as, I think, a difficult time because you were trying to be an actor and you were trying to break into the industry. And if I'm characterizing this incorrectly, please stop me. But I'm curious, in that time when you're trying to really find your feet, your footing, how do you manage to not be despondent, not to be undeterred and to keep going?
I don't know. I think about that once in a while, and I wonder how I had the crazy belief that I would make a living doing this. And that's all I ever expected, was to make a living. I didn't especially want to be a star. I didn't want to be famous. I worked out what I wanted in my early 20s. I had kind of serious ambitions, and I wanted three things. I wanted to be able to act in material that I respected with actors that I respected and admired in front of an audience that would get it.
Mm.
And it didn't matter to me where that was. And for a while, when I was asked to go to the Cleveland Playhouse, I think I would have been happy for an audience like that forever if I was doing things I cared about, but I wasn't doing many things that I cared about, so I went back to New York where I was able to do nothing that I cared about because I couldn't get work, you know.
Was it at all difficult to fully understand your ambition? And, you know, it sounds like you had very clear objectives.
Well, I never had a plan. A lot of people have five-year plans, and I always think Russia and China had a five-year plan every year, and it never worked. Life hands you your plan. So I was more of an improviser. Whatever I was handed, whatever was in front of me, I made the most of it. And by making the most of what was in front of me, I managed to climb a ladder, and it took a while. But I did have that strange belief that everything was going to work out okay, even though I had 9 years of hardly working at all, at least in my chosen profession. I worked as a doorman and a cab driver and one night as a waiter.
Where do you think that belief in yourself, that it was going to work out, where do you think that came from?
I don't know. It might have come from my mother, who unfortunately was psychotic. She was schizophrenic and paranoid and always told me that I could do anything, that whatever I wanted to do, I'd be successful at it.
Mm.
And I believed her. I mean, she wasn't what I thought of as what a mother should be, and probably wasn't like most mothers because she had an altered view of reality. She saw the devil. She heard voices.
Hmm.
I don't think she heard voices. She had more visual hallucinations. And she was extremely paranoid, kept telling me I was trying to kill her.
Were you?
No, but it starts to get to you after a while if they tell you that enough. But that didn't impress me as being a motherly thing to do. But the fact was, she really did love me. And in her own way, was very, very supportive of me, and probably gave me some self-confidence I might not have otherwise had. But I always had a lot of confidence.
Mm. You know, you've talked about MASH 1,000 times at this point. So I don't want to ask the same things over and over.
Well, this will be fun to see if you can ask something different.
Well, here's what I want to know is that it's 2018 now, and the show has grown into something almost mythological. And I'm wondering, today, in this moment, you know, it's, what, almost 4 o'clock in New York over there. How do you feel about the show? What do you make of it these days?
Well, when it was 3 o'clock, I was very proud of the show. Now at 4 o'clock, I feel even better about the show. I don't know what it is. Something about 4 o'clock just brings that out.
It ages better.
How do I feel about the show? I didn't know when we were doing it how popular it was and what an effect it was having on people. Over the 35 years since we ended the show, so many people have said to me, just I think this morning or yesterday, somebody said to me what I've heard hundreds of times, that they bonded with their parent because they watched the show either every day together or every week together, depending on when it was on. And a lot of women said that their fathers never talked about the wartime experience until they watched the show and then talked about it with them and cried. And then I had no idea that was having that effect, that the show was having that effect on people when we were doing it. There was no way to know that.
Mm.
So it's come in waves for me, the impact the show had, up until I started hearing those things. I was just proud that we had done some really good work, some not so good, some that I, at the time, we all said, oh, we've got to get past that. When we were doing the show, early, I think in the first season, there was a show where we played a prank on the Frank Burns character and painted his Jeep with gold paint because he was trying to find gold or something. It was a preposterous premise and a preposterous joke. And we said from then on, what is this in this script? Is this another gold Jeep? And we, you know, it became a catchphrase for us because we did one or two things that we thought were beneath the aspirations of the show. It was okay to be silly, but within the realm of plausibility, I think.
Mm.
Maybe we can take a page from her diary. And I'd like to start right now. And let a little of what I feel show through the cracks, through the wisecracks. To all the people here, who I've sweated with and endured with, you're very important to me. And I hope I do a better job of letting you know it. And to those closest to me who mean so much to me. Colonel Potter. Father Mulcahy. Klinger. Charles. And Beach. I love every one of you.
Were you hard on yourself in the beginning in your acting career?
I can't remember. I might have been. I don't know.
Mm. And how about now?
No. I guess one sign that I might have, I was very concerned and I wanted to, you know, is I thought the way to be better in a movie was to go see the rushes at the end of the day and correct things that I was doing wrong. And I think unless you really experience it doing that, it just tends to make you self-conscious.
Right.
And the more experienced I got, the less I wanted to do it. I never look at rushes now, even if I'm invited to. one time making a movie in Mexico, I was not invited, and I really wanted to see the Rushes. So I crawled up into the attic of the room next to where they were showing the Rushes, and I watched them through a hole in the wall.
And what did you find?
And I saw myself giving a not very good performance.
You know, that actually, I wanted to ask this. I didn't write this one down. So now I am just responding to you, Alan.
This is fantastic. I already feel excited.
Great. What is the worst performance you've given?
I don't know. Early on, I gave one that I didn't think was terrible. But a good friend who was an experienced actor said, I saw the show, and I don't think it will kill your career. So that probably was not a good performance.
That's good to hear. You know, my earliest interaction with your work is not MASH at all, but it was as a teenager watching Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Oh, I love that movie.
And what makes New York such a funny place is that there's so much tension and pain and misery and craziness here. And that's the first part of comedy. But see, you got to get some distance from it. You know what I mean? That the thing to remember about comedy is if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. So you got to get back from the pain. See what I mean? But like they said, they asked me up in at Harvard, a bunch of kids asked me, what's comedy? So I said, and then this is part of what I'm trying to say about getting back from it. I said, comedy is tragedy plus time. Tragedy plus time. See, when the night Lincoln was shot, you couldn't joke about it. You couldn't make a joke about that. You just couldn't do it. Now time has gone by, and now it's fair game.
Is that, what do you recall about making that film? Because it is a favorite of mine. It was then and it is now.
I think it's Woody's best movie and one of the best movies that we've made in America. I think it's brilliant, brilliant movie on many levels. And it's one of the few pieces of writing that I've ever seen that explores the idea that people who do really bad things don't necessarily pay for them, even internally.
Mm.
We like to believe that if the cops don't get you, that God will get you, or your own conscience will make you unhappy the rest of your life. And in this movie, it faces the fact, and I think it is a fact, that there are people who get away with murder, and it doesn't bother them. And it's a stark fact that takes away some of the sentimentality of our hope to do the right thing. You got to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not because you'll suffer from doing the bad thing.
Mm.
The only other place I saw that theme explored was in the book of Job, where Job is out in the desert with suppurating sores, and he says there are women crying in the desert, and there are other people who have all their cattle and their riches, and they did wrong. I did no wrong, and well, look at me.
You know, I don't think in that film, the character that Martin Landau was playing, by the end, I don't believe that he is going to continue his life without at least a sense of guilt.
You may be right, but I'd have to look at the movie again to look for a clue of that. I think you may be imposing that on your wish that bad behavior gets punished.
Mm.
You know, you think of all the dictators in the world who die rich. I mean, Saddam Hussein, if he wasn't caught in that hole, would be perfectly happy to keep doing what he did.
Huh.
I'm imagining. I never met the guy, so I don't know.
Do you think we're just taught that at an early age, that if you do something bad, there will be punishment? That there is a clear cause and effect?
It's sort of it's part of our culture. A lot of people assume it's true. There's a built-in desire to see bad behavior punished. There's a scientist in Switzerland, whose name I forget right now, who does studies on an fMRI, a functional MRI machine. And he sees that there's activity in the reward centers of the brain when someone is punished for an infraction or a supposed infraction.
Mm.
And that to me explains a lot. If we get happy from other people's punishment, maybe that is part of what explains capital punishment and the penal system.
Mm.
There are so many people in jail who are not there in a way where that the punishment is fitting the crime. But the more we can say three strikes and you're out, the bigger a shot of dopamine we may be getting. It's not rational, you know?
What's also not rational is that, especially in Hollywood, the general public, there is a joy that they have when they see someone famous, their dissension is attractive. People falling apart, people unraveling publicly for some reason.
Well, it becomes a spectacle, certainly. Do you know people who get happy about it? I mean, if the person has done evil things, really bad things, I can understand having a little cheer about them being caught. But if somebody is just as, you know, can't help being a shoplifter or something, that's just a sad thing. I don't know if people are happy about it, but they do spend a lot of time reading about it and watching television about it.
I think maybe not happy about it. I think there is a level of discourse. There's an amount of discussion where they seem to have removed, and this is a little bit at the heart of some of your ideology that I've read and been listening to. They seem to have removed the human being that they're talking about, and it is just a name. It is just a face.
Well, it's a little bit unavoidable. The problem of fame has been thought about and dealt with since the Greeks, the ancient Greeks. Somebody then said, fame is very easy to pick up and very hard to put down. On the one hand, it can be intoxicating, and on the other hand, it can be a burden.
Mm.
Part of the problem is you're not regarded as a person after a while. If you become in some way iconic, you're more like a cartoon character or a famous building. You're not a person. More than one person, including me, has been seen in a grocery store carrying a supersized pack of toilet paper to the checkout counter. And somebody says, don't you have somebody to do that for you? Well, no, I buy my own toilet paper. I'm a person. But this is not to blame the people. We developed as social animals, connecting to one another as people. But at a certain point, we developed this other thing that happened in the society where one of us would, or a very few of us would become famous people. Mm. And we don't know them personally. We only know them through the word about them. And that's why you had this kind of sometimes antipathy toward the famous person, because who are they to be famous? And that's true. Who are they to be famous? How does it happen? Sometimes it happens totally by accident. I pity people who get famous without being rich, because it's costly to be famous. And people who are rich and want to be famous too, I think, are really foolish. But the annoyance is funny. There's a story about the Greeks. They were voting on the person who was going to lead the government. And one guy said to another, don't write down the name. They had to write the name of the person they were voting for. He says, don't write down the name of Thermopylae the Good. And the other guy said, why? He says, nah, he's too good. He didn't even know anything about him. He just got annoyed with the name.
In your own life, do you feel regarded as a person?
In my own life? Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, people who recognize me are very kind to me. In the beginning, it was difficult because even though I had seen my father become famous, he went from burlesque to nightclubs to being a very famous movie star in the 40s and then a famous Broadway actor in the 50s. And even though I had seen him become famous and saw some of the drawbacks, I wasn't prepared for the kind of celebrity I had when MASH hit. And I couldn't go out on the street often without people pulling at me and grabbing me and saying to their friend, "Hey, Fred, look what I got." See, there's a real clear sign that they don't think they got a person. So people would, you know, be interrupting conversations with my children. And now they're very kind to me. So I really appreciate that.
They're kinder now because you're older?
I think they got used to the fact that I exist. That you can be known by a lot of people but not be hot. When I was known by a lot of people and hot, they didn't know how to react to it.
I understand.
It's very difficult when you see somebody you only know from a screen. I met on vacation once a 6-year-old boy who just kept staring at me for about 3 minutes. And then finally he said, "How did you get out of the TV?" Now, that's a 6-year-old reaction. But the funny thing is, we all have a kind of reaction like that. I've had it too. When I met Liv Ullmann, the great Swedish actress, I had had a crush on her for years. And now here she was standing talking to me in the parking lot of a Chinese restaurant. And I couldn't hear what she was saying. I was dazed because I was overcome by this thing. I'm talking to this famous person.
You know, I met her once too, and I had a very similar response. Take me to Manhattan Murder Mystery in 1993. You know, in the 90s, or just looking at your work in the 90s, did it come to a point where you realized you didn't have to work if you didn't want to?
Yeah, that went right after MASH. And I turned a lot of stuff down. I still turn a lot of stuff down. It's not on the grand scale that it was then. But I turned down big pictures because I just didn't want to be in them. I developed early on a standard, which was that I didn't want to spend 3 months making a movie that I didn't want to actually go see. You know, if everybody had that standard, there'd be very few movies made.
I was just about to say, I don't think many people have that same standard.
But I was lucky. I could afford to do what interested me. And as a result, that's partly how my life changed, because what really interested me was to do that television show called Scientific American Frontiers, where I interviewed hundreds of scientists. And from that, I became interested. And I did that for 11 years. Mm. And I became really interested in the idea that maybe we could train scientists to be as eloquent and personal and communicative as they were with me on the show, because I had this improvisational approach that we were talking about before. I didn't go in with a list of questions. I just went in with a little general knowledge and a lot of curiosity. Mm. And when I finally owned up to my ignorance, when I was made it clear that I really didn't know what they were talking about and I really needed them to help me understand it, that's when they were activated. It was like a trigger, and they became the real them. They weren't lecturing anymore. They weren't the professor. They were trying to get me, Alan, to understand what they were saying. And sometimes I'd grab them by the lapels and shake them. I don't get it. Say it again. Say it a different way. And when I finally understood it, there was a good chance that the audience would understand it. So I thought, why can't we teach scientists improvisation as a starting point, and then teach them ways to organize their their material, their ideas, what they have to say about their work. But based on that, the advantage that improv gives you, which is that you make contact with the person you're talking to. That's the main thing that improv is useful for in communication, is you get accustomed to taking in the other person, hearing what they're saying, listening, reading their face, reading their body language. And that's really important if you're trying to get somebody to understand something complicated, because if you're not aware of what they're going through while you're talking to them, you might as well be talking to a tree. Mm. So we did that, and I started to help start the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. That was 9 years ago, and we've taught, as of the moment, we've taught over 12,000 scientists and doctors in 5 countries, and we're scaling up. We're going to be doing much more.
Why do you think you want to make contact with people so passionately?
This is an interesting thing. It may be related in a curious way to the fact that I have strong social anxiety. If I have to go to a cocktail party, I dread it for days.
Do you really?
When people say, a party, I think, where can I go? Where can I go to get away from that? I hate parties. I finally, after doing the science show for 11 years and with all the experience in improvising, I finally learned how to make small talk. But what I do when I go to a party is the first person I run into, I start up a conversation with them about anything and just have the fun of having an improv conversation with this person I never met before, find out about them, playful with them, have a good time, a half hour goes by, and that's whoever I see first, even if it's a waiter. The waiters don't seem to mind.
What are you anxious about?
Well, that I don't know. I think that generally when people are nervous about strangers, it may be because they think something is going to be demanded of them. They're going to have to come up with something that they don't necessarily want to.
Hmm.
I tell you what it may be. It may be more than that. I just figured this out a while back. I found out a few years ago that I have face blindness. The technical term is prosopagnosia. It's a little fluke in your brain. And you have trouble recognizing faces. So you and I might have dinner and have a really good conversation for 3 hours.
Mm.
And the next day, I wouldn't recognize you.
Ah.
Twice I didn't recognize my own daughter. So I think if you walk into a room and you know some of the people are going to be people you've seen before and expect you to know who they are, and some will be pure strangers, but they all look like strangers, that can make you anxious. And I have a feeling I've been anxious all my life and didn't know that I had face blindness until a little while. I didn't know it existed. Most people don't know it exists. So I say, they say, we met before, we had dinner together, or we worked together on that committee. Or I say, I'm really sorry, I have face blindness. They say, oh yeah, I do too. And then they think it's some kind of excuse. I got face blindness. I got the fusiform gyrus or whatever it's called is screwed up in my head.
Mm. That is, I'm sorry.
This is an unusual interview. I usually don't give my entire medical history.
Well, you know, that's actually one of the things we require of people on the show, is that they deliver that to us.
I hope I'll be able to get my driver's license after this.
You will, and your passport. My natural gut response to that is I feel bad. I'm not trying to pity you.
Which part do you feel bad about?
I feel bad that is part of your moment-to-moment, day-to-day interactions with other human beings.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I'm glad you said that because I wouldn't want to leave you or anybody else with that feeling. Because you should know that part of my confidence about life is that anything like that that happens to me becomes, to me, a chance to solve a puzzle, to figure my way out of a maze. And I enjoy that. It's fun. Once in a while, it gets frustrating, but I cope with it. And having a problem to solve is—it's like when you write something. Everything you write has a writing problem, and you don't throw the pen down to say, "Oh, I have no inspiration today." You solve the problem. It's fun, so you don't have to feel sad.
Well, in my case, I just keep revising and revising until I'm on the verge of throwing my computer out the window. That's when I print, or that's when I send.
If you can catch it in time. Yeah, well, that's good. But that, you don't enjoy, you're saying you don't enjoy the process of solving the problem?
Oh, that's a good question.
Sometimes I don't enjoy it either, but I aim toward having fun. We're only here for a short time. People think it's a long time. It's not very long. And no matter how long you last, the oldest person we know of is 122, was 122. Mm. And I just read an article, or actually just a headline, I don't know what the gist of it is, that they have found some indication that 122 is not the limit. And I know I was told on one of the shows we did by about a dozen people who were experts in longevity that with all kinds of changes that are going to be taking place, artificial organs, better nutrition, gene therapy, computer replacements for parts, that will routinely live to 200 or 250. Even when we do, that's not a long time. Because it's never long enough. The idea that you're going to be extinguished when you finally realize that that is the most factual part of, it's the most factual fact about life, then you think, well, that wasn't very long. You know? It seems like it's going to last forever when you're a kid. But then you start to realize it's shorter. So if it's not going to last that long, I think it would be a good idea to feel good about things as much as you can. Why spend that time in misery or anxiety? So if there's a puzzle to solve, have fun solving it.
At your age, I don't know, do you feel okay with the end?
Oh, yeah. I don't want it to happen, but I don't mind it. Things changed radically for me when I almost died in Chile 15 years ago.
2003.
Yeah, I was within 2 years of... I was within 2 hours of dying. And I had an emergency operation. And I woke up alive, and it was a really good feeling. But at the same time, I thought, when they put the mask on me and gave me the anesthetic, that could have been it. I could have never have awakened from that. So I had like a rehearsal of dying, and I realized I didn't have a moment of thinking, oh God, what's going to happen? You know, is there a heaven? None of that came to mind. The only thing that came to mind was I want to write a note to my wife to say goodbye, tell her I love her. So the producer of the show wrote down what I said, and then he lost a note.
You're kidding. You're kidding.
Yeah. I would have faced utter disappearance.
You're full of shit. That did not happen.
Even my last words.
Did that really happen?
Yes. So I didn't worry about dying while I thought I might be dying. And I woke up not worried about dying, but really glad to be alive. So it's possible to have both of those thoughts at once. I do everything I can to stay alive and healthy. But I think I'll be extinguished at one point, and that'll be that. That's the way it works. The real pain is for the people who are left. That's a sad thing.
Do you feel satisfied with what you've done in your life?
Satisfied is a funny word for what I feel. Some of the things I've done, I came pretty close to doing the best I could do. Some, I made a mistake trying to do them and made a mistake in the way I did them. So some things I'm happy about, some things not, in terms of artistic things I've done. But
what are you talking about?
I just know that there are movies and plays that I've done that I didn't do a good job in. So I can't say I'm satisfied with it, except I'm satisfied in that once I do something, whether it's good or bad, I let it go. So I'm content. Satisfied means I'm pleased with myself. But I'm content because I'm always trying to do a better job next time. That's where I put my thinking. I really don't look back on the past much. I'm polite when people want to talk about MASH, but if I could have my way, I wouldn't talk about it at all.
Alan, can I ask you something that is purely out of genuine curiosity?
Yeah.
I don't know you. I mean, you don't know me. We're ostensibly two strangers on the telephone for the last hour. Doing our best to amuse one another.
Are you going to ask me out?
Yeah, actually, could I have your phone number? I'll write you for a date sometime.
So go ahead. We're strangers, yes. And
my genuine question is, in this hour, question for question, answer for answer, I've been struck by how goddamn positive you are.
So what are you curious about?
I'm curious how do you get to that place in your life?
I don't know. I have no idea. I am pretty positive. It doesn't mean I don't get low, and I have been depressed at times, anxious. So those things aren't very positive. But maybe because I know if I'm not positive and work really hard to stay on top of things, I'll be under them. So I have I got through those 9 years not working as an actor just with blind survival. I just was going to survive. I once was, when I was 12, I was with my parents at a hotel in La Jolla, California, and they were asleep, and I went down to the beach to swim. It was a little cove, and there was nobody there but me. And I didn't know I didn't know what an undertow was, or a riptide, or whatever it was I got caught in. And the ocean pulled me out from the shore, and then I was underwater the whole time. Then a wave would pick me up and slam me on the shore. And I thought it was fun. And then it would pull me out again and slam me on the shore. And then I thought, well, okay, this has been fun, but now I'm getting tired. I'm going to get out now. And I couldn't. Every time I tried to get out, the water would pull me back. The ocean would pull me back and slam me hard on the shore. And then I thought, if I don't do something, I'm going to die here. This is going to drown me. And I started digging my fingers into the sand and pulling myself with my fingers up the beach. It took several minutes before the ocean couldn't pull me back in again. Maybe I got something out of that experience, or maybe I had something about me that enabled me to survive that experience and all the ones that come along since then. But that's how I approach it now. I just dig my fingers in and pull myself out of it. So I hope that keeps working.
I have a feeling that it will.
That would be nice, but you never know what's coming. I came up with a way to say that. I think you can't fight uncertainty. Uncertainty is going to be your meal at every mealtime and in between. Unwanted snacks of uncertainty. You never know what's going to happen, but all you can do is surf uncertainty. And if surfing it can be, you know, the fun of surfing, the danger, the pleasure of making it without cracking your head open, you might as well make it a good game because it's going to happen. That's what I think. That's how mostly I get through.
Well, that's about as much as we can do. Alan Alda, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
So long.
Special thanks this week to Alan Alda. We did that episode over Skype more than a year ago. He was in New York, and it was an absolute joy and privilege to talk to him. To learn more about Alan, you can do so on our website at talkeasypod.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at talkeasypod. If you'd like to consider donating to the podcast, you can learn more about how and where to do that at talkeasypod.com/donate. As always, the show is executive produced by David Chen, graphics by Ian Jones, illustrations by Krishna Shenoy. Our social media is by Ghani Zur. Our music is by Dylan Peck and Jin Sang. Our engineer is Tim Moore. Our associate producer is Caroline Reebok. I've been pronouncing it wrong for 3 weeks. She just corrected me because she's a polite, kind person. And finally, the show is produced by Neil Innes. I'm Sam Fragoso. We'll be back next week with another one of my favorite episodes. I don't want to say who, but it's a person close to my heart. I'll see you then. Have a good week, everyone.